We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
From WILL Illinois Public Media, this is Focus. Good morning, I'm Celeste Quinn. Harriet Williamson is the producer of the program. Our technical director this morning, Jason Croft. Think exploration and adventure. I suspect what comes to mind are mountains, oceans, and space. Well, this morning we're going to look in another direction. We're going to get a glimpse of Earth's deepest caves and the people who explore them. These explorers may spend weeks plunged into absolute darkness, thousands of feet below the surface. If they run into any problem, it is serious. It can be deadly. It has been deadly. Our guest is James Tabor, author of Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. The quest involves two teams of cavers, one headed by American Bill Stone, another headed by Ukrainian Alexander Klimchuk. They set out to find the bottom of the world. Tabor tells their harrowing stories in Blind Descent. Listeners, you can join us with a phone call or by email this morning. I look forward to hearing from you. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. James Tabor is a journalist, editor, and filmmaker. His work has appeared in magazines, on cable, and on PBS. His latest book was Forever on the Mountain. His new book, Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455, and WILL-talk@illinois.edu. James Tabor, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, and I'm very happy to be here with you.
Oh, I'm delighted to talk with you. What a story, or what a combination of stories. So first, to begin with, what's the definition of what you call a super cave? What sets a super cave apart from other caves?
Well, you know, I will tell you that as I was doing the research for the book, I was already very familiar with mountaineering, and I knew that there was a special term for a special group of mountains called the 8,000ers, or the 8,000-meter peaks, and there are 14 of those. And they're this special family. You could almost call them super mountains because each one of them is higher than 8,000 meters. Well, I found that there was no similar special term for these great, great caves, and there's only a handful of them on Earth that are deeper than a vertical mile and have many, many miles of labyrinthine passages. So I thought they deserved their own name, and so I came up with the term super cave, and that's where that came from.
Yeah. Now, one of the caves in the story is roughly speaking, about 4,900 feet deep. Another is, roughly speaking, 6,800 feet deep. Now, of course, one is deeper, but I'm wondering which is the greater challenge to explore. Does depth itself, is that a challenge, or are there other issues?
Well, of course, if you ask the respective teams, they'll both tell you that, well, by golly, my cave is the toughest. the fact is that the caves are very different, and each presents its own unique challenges. So the Mexican cave, which, you, as you've said, is about 4,900 feet deep, Cheve, it's shaped like a giant L, and the vertical shaft is about 3,000 feet, roughly, and then the long... There's a long foot that goes another 2.5 miles and drops another 2,000 feet. The challenge in Cheve, quite frankly, is there are so many vertical pitches. There are more than 90 vertical pitches that require the cavers to get on and off rope over and over and over again, and that's really exhausting. Now, in contrast, Krubera, the great cave in the Republic of Georgia, if you look at its profile, it looks almost like an elevator shaft. It is essentially a vertical cave all its way down, 6,800 feet. That means that the cavers are on one or several ropes 90% of the time. It's technical terrain. But the other thing about Krubera is it's cold. The average air temperature in Krubera is 34 degrees Fahrenheit, and the water temperature in it is 32 degrees Fahrenheit because it's fed by glacial melt. So, so they have, you know, they have their unique challenges.
Can you give us some sense of what it's like being in a super cave?
Sure. The first thing that you become aware of is the darkness. For your listeners who may be divers or snorkelers, you know that when you're in the water, you know, you really feel the water as a palpable presence. And as you go deeper and deeper into these great caves, the same thing happens with darkness. You become constantly aware of it, and it almost has a weight kind of pressing in. The other thing you notice is that there's so much verticality in these great caves. There's just an amazing amount of rappelling, sometimes down into pits that are 500 feet deep. I mean, big enough you could put the Washington Monument in. Mm. And then the other thing is the water. These great caves are formed by the action of water on soluble limestone over eons. And so the deeper you go into the great caves, the more powerful the water courses are. I've seen some in the United States where you could do class 3 kayaking on. I mean, right, you know, rivers underground that forceful. So those are the three things I think that impinge on you most dramatically.
Yeah, well, I think already we have a sense of how dangerous this exploration can be. The title of chapter 1 is Stop, We Have a Fatality. And here readers learn of the death of a young man from Indiana named Chris Yeager. What happened?
Well, it was just such an unfortunate incident from a number of standpoints. There had been a major expedition on site at Cheve, the Great Cave in Mexico, for weeks, and it was led by Bill Stone. This is 1991, if I recall correctly. And Chris Yeager was not part of that expedition. He showed up uninvited. He was an inexperienced caver, and he was warned repeatedly by the senior cavers in the expedition not to go into Cheve because it would, I say in the book, it would be like someone who had only climbed little mountains in Vermont suddenly deciding to go straight up Everest, you know. Well, he went in, and he got in trouble very quickly after just, you know, 7 or 8 hours. And what happened was he mishandled a rappel, you know, sliding down a rope and fell 75 feet to his death. So that was a tragedy, an utter tragedy. But it was also followed by some controversy over how to deal with the presence of his body. And that, you know, created a whole sort of subsequent story of bad relations and controversy and stuff that really ended up in the cessation of that particular expedition.
Yeah. Now, Chris Yeager was not an experienced deep cave explorer. But even for the most experienced, the dangers are many. What came with the book was a list of 52 ways to die in a cave. Rope failure, of course, but chemical contamination of rope, exhaustion, hypothermia, hyperthermia, drowning, becoming lost, being out of light, that's an obvious one, I suppose, poisonous snakes and insects. So how do you become experienced enough to do this and have a chance at it?
Well, you pay your dues year after year after year, acquiring experience and acquiring skills, as, say, you know, great mountaineers do. I mean, you don't start in super caves, obviously. You start in small caves with experienced cavers, and you learn the techniques. You learn the vertical rope work, the climbing and rappelling. You learn how to deal with water that comes up to your chin, you know, and when the ceiling is scratching your helmet. You learn how to deal with extended periods underground. So the folks who are on these leading edge extreme expeditions have almost all been doing it for a decade or more, and they have worked their way up to the skill levels that allow them to do these things, if not safely, at least with a minimum of risk.
How do they maintain their psychological well-being?
Boy, it's harder than you might think, and there are several reasons. One of them is because of the darkness. As I said before, the darkness is just a constant presence, and so your mind is never fully free of the awareness of it, but it also does weird things like it reduces the effectiveness of your immune system. So you're much more prone to infections and things like that. I think the way that the serious experienced extreme cavers deal with that kind of thing is, first of all, by working their way up to it, you know, gradually over a number of years, but also by maintaining really, really close team relations with the other members of their particular groups. You ask them all, and they will all say the support of team members is essential to one's mental health down in these caves.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus is James Tabor. He's the author, most recently, of Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this morning with your questions, with comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. And the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm certain that you have been following the story of the miners in Chile. 33 miners have been trapped a half mile below the surface since August 5th, 2010. It's now September 3rd, 2010. Given what you know about being so far below the surface, what are your thoughts about their situation?
Well, my first thought is that it dramatically highlights the difference between mining, which is an extraordinarily dangerous activity in its own right, and extreme caving. There are procedures in place for miners' rescue when they are trapped like this. I mean, there are protocols and procedures, and as horrible as the situation is, they at least have communication with the surface, and there are measures being taken. When you get down deep into a super cave, you have no communication with the surface, so you're literally more isolated than you would be on the far side of the moon. And if anything happens to you, you have to self-rescue. And most extreme deep cavers will tell you that if you get seriously hurt or become seriously ill days into one of these caves, you're just not going to come out, that you will not be able to be rescued by yourself or your companions. So that really sets cave exploration apart, not only from mining, but from extreme high-altitude mountaineering. I mean, the French put a helicopter on top of Everest in 2005, you know, so and from even deep oceaneering. So that's really the first thing that, I mean, my heart goes out to the miners, but I also think that the cavers have it even worse.
Yeah. Will there come a time when there will be communication possible between people deep below the surface of the earth, cavers, and the surface?
I think so. They have been experimenting with a type of communication line that actually uses the earth as a grounding source and partly transmits electrical signals through the earth back to the surface. So it's not refined and it's not dependable yet, but it is being experimented with. And my guess is that, yes, you know, within the next 5 to 10 years, there will be that kind of communication.
Yeah. One of the principles of this story, Blind Descent, is a man named Bill Stone. And he's a remarkable fellow. He's not only is he an explorer, but he's an inventor.
Yeah, he is. And I will tell you that two scientific breakthroughs really made possible the exploration of these world's deepest caves. One of them was back in the 1960s, anyway, when some southern cavers invented devices that allowed them to rappel down into these incredibly great depths and then climb back out again on a single rope. So that was one thing. The other thing was Bill Stone's invention of a compact scuba rebreather, which was small, rugged, and would provide cavers with up to 12 to 18 hours of dive time. Because when you go into these great caves, inevitably there are flooded tunnels or channels that you have to pass through with scuba gear. And had Bill not invented those things, traditional scuba gear had reached its limits. So those two things were absolutely critical.
Yeah. He chafes at being called an adventurer.
He sure does. He snapped at an interviewer from National Geographic one time who started off by saying, "Let's talk about your adventurers." And he said, "Whoa, let's dispense with that term right now. I'm a scientist exploring the Earth, retrieving data for the good of humankind. I do not do adventures." So he thinks of himself, and I think correctly, first as a scientist and then second as an explorer. And his counterpart, the Ukrainian, Alexander Klimchuk, will tell you the same thing. He said, adventure is what happens when stuff goes wrong. You know, you don't want to have an adventure. You want to have an expedition. And they both really are extraordinarily competent and successful scientists.
So adventurer equals amateur.
That's exactly right. You know, that's very, very well put, because someone without the skills and the experience and everything it takes, Chris Yeager is a good example, has adventures, and adventures often have unfortunate outcomes.
Yeah. On the other hand, there is something of some kind of drive that makes these people tick, these men and women. They're wired differently than I am. I don't know about you.
I think they're wired differently even than I am, too. You know, every time I meet one of these extreme explorers, whether it's in the mountains or aeronautics or caving, I ask them, of course, well, why do you do it? And Bill Stone's answer to that question was one of the most informing, I think, I ever heard. He said, it's not a matter of choice. I do this because I have to. And it has been a very insidious relationship. So I think you're right. There are people who are so drawn to their activities, whether it's high-altitude mountaineering or oceaneering or caving, that really it's almost irresistible. You know, George Lee Mallory, the great Everest pioneer, was a classic example of that. He kept going back to the mountain until it finally killed him. And there are other examples. But I think at the highest level, these folks are drawn by an almost irresistible urge to go where no one has gone before and to be first at something.
Mm. The other principal character in the story is Alexander Klimchuk. We've just mentioned him, but you describe him as being Stone's polar opposite, but yet they share some similarities.
You know, I observe that if you tried to genetically engineer Bill Stone's opposite, you couldn't have done a better job than Alexander Klimchuk. Stone is a big, big guy. He's 6'4", he weighs 200 pounds, he's just a solid rock of muscle, and he's a classic alpha male. Alexander is a small man, he's 5'8", he weighs about 145 pounds wet, and he's almost shy and retiring. He's a very self-effacing fellow. And whereas Bill's style is to always be in the front, always leading, always doing the most dangerous and the hardest work, Alexander has done those things, but he's also more likely to delegate leadership to other people to take care of expeditions that he himself has planned. So their approaches are radically different, but interestingly enough, equally successful.
Who would you rather be a team member for?
Wow, you know, that's a great question, and no one has ever asked me that. I'm going to hedge a little bit, and I will tell you that I would love to go with either one of them, because I have been on expeditions led by leaders with both styles, and as long as they are in control of themselves and their environment and their activities enough to always have safety as a primary concern, it's an honor and a pleasure to go with either one of them. So I will tell you that I did try to get into both of those caves as part of my research. Krubera is located in Abkhazia, which is just a terribly tempestuous region with a lot of separatist fighting and stuff, and it's off limits to Americans. And Bill's expeditions were finished by the time I started doing my research. But I'd love to go with either one of them.
Yeah. Now, you have, as you mentioned, you've been in caves. What's your experience been like?
Well, I started caving up in the Pacific Northwest, going into lava tube caves. This is way back before even Mount St. Helens exploded. And I migrated from that down to what we call TAG, which is Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. It's the southeastern United States. And because they're geological substrata down there is just thousands of feet of soluble limestone. They have thousands and thousands of wonderful caves. It's really a mecca. And I did. I got into the biggest caves that I was involved in down there. And I finished up my caving career in the early 90s. I'm 62 now, but I finished up in the early 90s with some caving, extreme caving up in Canada. So I will tell you that, you know, I've done 250-foot vertical drops, and I've gone through places where you have to exhale all your breath to squeeze through, and I've been a Sherpa, you know, carrying scuba tanks and things like that. So what I say is that I've kind of encountered piecemeal most of the challenges that the super cavers experience, but they do it for 30 days at a time.
Mm. We know the names of Perry and Hillary and Armstrong and Aldrin, but we really don't know the names of the explorers you write about in Blind Descent. Couple questions come to mind here. Why is that the case, and how did you learn about these particular explorers?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that question, because it goes right to one of the two reasons I wrote the book, and that is to try to gain some recognition, some parallel recognition for these people who are doing activities that are just as dangerous as anything Perry or Amundsen, or really even the astronauts did, and are generating really some significant scientific benefits as well, but are completely unknown. And here's why. I think you can, as you said in your introduction, you can see a mountain, you know, you can see an ocean, you can even see the moon, but you can't see a cave. And so they have really remained out of our collective awareness for that reason, partly. And the other one is that it has been much harder to retrieve images from deep, deep, deep in these caves than those other environments until very recently. So now we're beginning to see these things, you know, with the advent of digital photography and great batteries and things. So I think those are the two reasons why. And in my opinion, their accomplishments really do rank with those great legendary explorers that, you know, that you just mentioned.
Yeah. There are some wonderful photographs in your book, and there are also more photos online. They're spectacular.
Oh, thank you. I was very fortunate that the Extreme Cavers allowed me to use a number of their photographs in the book. And, you know, geologists say the underground world is the eighth continent, and that's true. I mean, they sometimes believe that there's more explorable space down there than there is on the surface, and it is such another world that it's, even for a professional writer, words are almost inadequate, and that's why the pictures are so important, and I'm glad you mentioned them, because they are on the website, blinddescent.com, and in the book as well.
Yeah. Well, another thing that you mentioned, I think, very early in the book is that, you know, to see someone in a beautiful white spacesuit set down on the moon is a different thing from, you know, climbing into the earth and getting all dirty and wet and bruised.
Oh, yeah. that's so true. I mean, as I was doing the research, I just came across that classic picture of Neil Armstrong on the moon, you know, standing by the flag and saluting. And I mean, he really looks like a white knight in this, you know, gleaming, immaculate suit of armor. It's just a public relations person's dream. But when cavers come out of a cave after a month underground, they look like they've been, you know, climbing through a sewer for a month. I mean, they're covered with mud. They're filthy. They lose a pound a day. They're pale as fish bellies because there's no sunlight. And they're a PR person's nightmare, quite frankly, because they look so bad.
That's not it. There's no glamour attached.
That's true.
To it at all. This is Focus, and our guest this morning in the first hour of the program is James Tabor. He is the author of Blind Descent. Blind Descent, the quest to discover the deepest place on Earth. We're talking this morning about Earth's deepest caves and the people who explore them. These explorers may spend weeks plunged into absolute darkness, thousands of feet below the surface. And if they run into any problem at all, it is very serious. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I hope you'll join the discussion this morning with a phone call or by email. Questions and comments are invited. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. I had lunch with a biology major the other day here at the University of Illinois, and she had actually heard of this work. And here now, let's talk about what you call these caves in terms of their scientific opportunities. You call them scientific cornucopias.
I do for, a variety of reasons. From my perspective, I think the most valuable does have to do with biology. And I'm not surprised that your biologist friend knew about this work, because it's really beginning to receive some extraordinary attention. And here's why. Deep down in these caves, biologists a while ago found life forms that they call extremophiles. They're from the Archaea family, and they are related to the extreme organisms that live in those the geothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean, that live in volcanoes. They've actually found them, and other just amazingly alien places. Well, some biologists took some of these extremophiles out of the cave and brought them into the laboratory and started to experiment with them, and they found, amazingly enough, that they were able to formulate the beginnings of new antibiotics. And what's good about that is because they are drugs that our current drug-resistant bacteria never, ever encountered. So they show they have the potential to work against all those, you know, MRSA and staph and pseudomonas and all those things that are now pretty much immune to our drugs. So that's a huge advance coming out of caves.
Yeah. And also, as I understand it, they're offering clues to how the Earth was formed and life forms that may be out there in deep space.
Yeah, there's a whole emerging field called astrobiology. And I would say its major focus is trying to figure out how these life forms, these extremophiles, how they managed to survive in caves for millions of years in absolute darkness with no apparent form of nutrition, not photosynthesis. And they're looking at that because they think that if we find life on Mars, it's going to be under the surface in those kinds of conditions. And so they're very fascinated by those things. I'll tell you, another area is that Alexander Klimchuk's specialty is hydrogeology, the study of water beneath the surface. And deep caving is giving us a lot of new information about the giant aquifers that are down there that really we depend on for life up here on the surface, you know, how they're formed, mm-hmm. how they communicate with each other, how they get polluted, a variety of things. So yet another scientific benefit, really.
Yeah. Let's take a call. We've got a listener waiting online, one for us in Champaign. Good morning.
Hi. I read your book and really loved it. It was just like a thrill ride. And have told some people who even live in the neighborhood that you recommended in the South who had no idea of what's going on beneath them. But I had one question. When scientists go to these sites, what's to keep them from just sticking a precious mineral in their own pocket and then selling it on eBay? That's what I would want to do.
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for your kind words about the book. I really appreciate that, and I'm very glad that you enjoyed it. I think the thing that prevents them is just their sense of scientific ethics. But that said, I will tell you that many wild cave explorers refuse to reveal the location, the exact location of the caves that they're working on, for the very reason that you just mentioned. Not so much the scientists taking stuff out, removing artifacts or valuable mineral formations, but less scientific, more recreational cavers who will do that. So it's the scientists, I really think, I think scientists believe about their caves, these speleologists, the way divers feel about coral reefs. You know, they understand that they're sacred, they're fragile, and they really, really revere them, quite honestly. But it's a good question. I'm glad you posed it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call, a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hello. I have two questions. Maybe you said this. I got in on the program a little bit late. But I'm very curious. How do you see in the cave when it's dark all the time? And the other question is, did you have to learn to use your sense of touch to do this exploring?
Boy, those are really good questions. Cavers all have triply redundant light sources down in the caves. So, and with the advent of LED or light-emitting diode technology, we have lights that use such a small amount of battery power that they can literally stay underground for weeks and still have light. However, the battery power is still a precious resource, and light is your most important asset down there. So unless you're actually traveling or performing some task, your lights are off, and you're existing most of the time in that kind of complete darkness. That does make your sense of touch very, very important. Not that people will actually move around on serious travels without lights, but they will take a mental snapshot of, say, a campsite area before they turn off their lights, and they will move around that as a blind person would. So both good questions, and those are the answers to those.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. Well, what does it sound like in these caves, and what does it smell like?
The sound is very interesting. I think a lot of people who have been in touristic caves especially think the caves are quiet, and nothing could be farther from the truth. For one thing, you have water. Water is always flowing through the caves, and the deeper you get, the louder it gets. So Bill Stone, for example, had a camp deep in one cave where he said that the water was so loud it was like being 50 feet from a 747 engine that you couldn't turn off. So that's the extreme, but there's always the sound of water. The other thing is there's a sound of wind, because all caves breathe. Diurnal pressure changes and temperature changes at the surface mean that air is either going into a cave basically half the day or coming out. So you have air moving, and some, the big caves, they can really, really blast. They've clocked the air at a New Mexican cave called Lechuguilla at 70 miles an hour. So
that's hurricane force.
You've got those two things. You've got wind and water. And what they smell like, you know, I have always been fascinated by the way that wild caves smell. I'm a hockey player, and so the closest analog I can tell you is that they kind of smell like a hockey rink, that clean, cold smell of ice. But there's a garden, kind of an organic edge to it as well. It's almost indescribable, and you can't take a picture of it, but that's the best I can do.
Yeah. Well, how cold can it be, and how hot can it be?
Oh, boy. Well, the hottest caves are, you know, up around 140, almost 150 degrees, and some of you listeners may have seen those pictured on a National Geographic special where they have these gigantic crystals, and the cavers have to wear special suits to cool them down, and they can only be in these particular areas for, I think, 20 minutes. On the other extreme, caves can be really, really cold. The Great Cave Krubera in the Republic of Georgia, cavers actually prefer to explore that in the wintertime because the risk of flooding is much, much less. So the ambient air temperature in the cave at that point gets down close to 0 degrees Fahrenheit, and the water stays at 32 degrees Fahrenheit because it's glacial melt. So you put that together with a wind, you know, like 10, 15 miles an hour, and you've got chill factors down below zero.
Mm. This is Focus. Our guest this morning, James Tabor, author of Blind Descent, The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. Let's take another call. This is from a listener in Belgium, Illinois. Line 4, hi.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I think your guest just mentioned what I was going to talk about. There are caves, I think they're in Mexico, that really aren't caves until the mining comes along and hits the pocket, and then all the water rushes out, and then the caves have these huge crystals inside of it. Have you mentioned those?
Thanks for your question. We just did, as a matter of fact, and you're right. I believe that's the way that the cave of the giant crystals that National Geographic featured in its television special, I think that was the way it was originally discovered.
Yeah.
And that's also the way that, you know, other caves are. Sometimes these giant earth movers will be digging around, and they'll find a portal into which cavers will go very very eagerly, because they love, you know, when they have a new opportunity. But yeah, that's a good point.
In this particular situation, though, I think the caves are actually full of liquid, and so they're not really available to human beings until they puncture through to them. And that causes a problem for the mine, because obviously the mine is flooded with the liquid once it's opened up. But then they are able to get into it, the way I understand it. And
that would have to
be an amazing situation, completely pristine.
Yeah, absolutely. And they do that. In fact, I have a classmate of mine from the University of Vermont, has been leading for a number of years the exploration of great aquifers down in the southern Mexican area, the entrance to which, in some cases, is just what you described. And they will go, using very sophisticated scuba equipment, they'll go miles. I think they've charted hundreds of miles of underground, completely flooded, completely pristine. And, of course, they get to say the same thing. I just went underwater to a place that no human being ever had been before. And that's one of the great attractions of surface caving, is dry caving as well.
And in these caves with these large crystals, I assume, do they kind of guard them? Because I would think some of those crystals would be quite valuable. I mean, obviously, the huge ones you couldn't get out, but there's probably some small ones.
Yeah, they do. My understanding is that the Mexican government has restricted access, for one thing, because they're extraordinarily dangerous, but they're also, as you point out, they're valuable, has restricted access to that cave, just as our government has restricted access to a new Mexican cave called Lechuguilla, because it is fairly easy to get down into, but extraordinarily dangerous once you're in there, and full of totally unique speleothems, or formations, as they call it. So, yeah, protection of that kind of stuff is very important.
And if I might bring out one other kind of ancillary topic, and it seems to be a problem here in the Midwest and the East, people who go into these caves are now introducing diseases or things to bats. Have you brought that up yet?
We haven't. I think you're talking about white nose syndrome.
Exactly.
My best information at this point is the jury is still out. There is some evidence that cavers may have introduced the virus that is killing the bats, but apparently there's an equal almost amount of evidence saying that no, cavers had nothing to do with it, that this virus had another source. And I don't think the question has been fully completely answered yet, but cavers are certainly aware of it. It's an unfortunate thing, because we're losing thousands of bats here in the East as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this morning. Other calls are invited. Questions, comments, give us a call. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. You may also join us by email. The email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Unfortunately, where people go, we when we go places, we tend to mess them up. I'm thinking of, you can think of the beach, you can think of Mount Everest. Is there some kind of a code in terms of what you pack in, you pack out?
Exactly. I mean, you just described it. What everything that goes in comes out, and that includes in most cases the production of bathroom functions, let's say, which goes into plastic bags, is sealed, put into lidded containers, and brought out. I should explain that in these giant caves, there are load carriers or Sherpas going down to the multiple camps and back up every day, all day long. I mean, there's constant traffic down into and out of the caves to restock the camps with supplies, bring down fresh batteries, just a whole bunch of things. And one of the things they do is take out, day by day, all the trash, all the detritus, and the other stuff as well. And then there's a process called de-rigging. After an expedition is over, everything that they put in place, all their ropes, their campsites, everything is pulled out of the cave. So it is left essentially in the same pristine condition, you know, except for footsteps and things like that on sandy areas, that it was when they came in. And that is a very, very strict ethic, yes.
Yeah. One of the, going back to the 52 ways to die in a cave, one of the ways is number 29, chemical contamination of rope. I guess your stuff has to be clean and in good shape and in proper working order, but it has to be clean?
Well, there are a couple of things that can happen there. First of all, the most dangerous chemical that can contaminate the rope is sodium chloride or salt, which accumulates on them from the cavers themselves, their hands and sweat. Mm-hmm. And the reason that's dangerous is because up near the surface, it attracts animals, rodents and other kinds, that really like to chew on salty things. And there have been cases where they've chewed completely through ropes. Cavers will take other kinds of chemicals down into a cave. The rebreathers I just mentioned use an exotic chemical called lithium dioxide as a scrubber to remove carbon dioxide from a diver's recirculated breath. That's not good stuff to get on a rope, nor is, not many, but some cavers use carbide in carbide lamps. It's pretty much a thing of the past, but certainly was for, decades. And carbide is also a bad thing for rope. It'll eventually weaken it. So those are the. But I think salt is probably the worst thing.
That's interesting. So, in these caves, we might come across rodents, bats. What else is down there?
You might come across those things fairly close to the surface. Once you get down beyond about 500 or 700 vertical feet, those things' abilities to survive pretty much stops. However, several years ago, some cavers did find, I think this is fascinating, a colony of troglodytic scorpions 1,000 feet down in one of the Mexican caves associated with Cheve. So we didn't think that those kinds of life forms could exist down there, but oops, well, we were wrong again, and they found the scorpions. But really, when you get very, very deep, the only thing that is able to exist are these extremophiles that I mentioned, these microbial life forms. And by golly, they'll do it for millennia.
Yeah. It's been some time now, but I remember talking with someone, I think, from the Illinois Natural History Survey about some fish that live in some caves in southern Illinois.
Yeah, troglodytic fish are fairly common, actually. They're eyeless. These are the famous eyeless things. And they live, they can't live, let me see, they have to be close enough to the surface that there is some organic matter in the water that they live in, I guess, for them to survive. But yes, sure enough. Spiders, too. One of the cavers from Cheve brought a picture back of a black venomous spider as big as a big man's hand. And it was on the wall several hundred feet down, and everybody just made a wide berth around that fella.
Yeah. Oh, thank goodness for the pictures.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's as close as I want to get. So, the overarching story you tell in Blind Descent, I suppose, is set in terms of a race. This is what makes it such a good read, as one of our callers mentioned. But, once the race is run, there's so much work left to be done. What's going on now?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, these extreme cave expeditions are, they're like the first, they're the pathfinders, if you will. They're like the first astronauts who landed on the moon and proved, A, that humans could get to such a place, and B, that they could exist down there and perform activities. So the pathfinders do that. And then once they've opened the way, the scientists come behind them. So the microbiologists are in there. The hydrogeologists are in there. And this is very, very interesting, I think. For some time, NASA has been following the dynamics of these extreme cave teams, the human performance people at NASA, because they replicate better than any surface simulation could the conditions that, say, Mars crews are going to encounter on their long flights. In other words, they're absolutely constrained in an extraordinarily hazardous environment for a long, long period of time with the same people. And you can do a simulation on the surface, but if somebody has appendicitis, well, you end it and it's over. Down in a cave, it's just like in a space capsule. If somebody gets sick or hurt, you can't end it. So they've been fascinated looking at those things.
How do people like Alexander Klimchuk and Bill Stone put together a team?
Oh, boy. You know, they, for one thing, both of those guys have been doing this extreme caving most of their adult lives. I think Alexander began when he was 11, and Bill Stone started when he was 16. So they're very conversant with the relatively small population of cave explorers worldwide who are competent to do this kind of caving. there are no shortage of candidates, actually. They will line up when they learn of an expedition. But in Bill Stone's case, he puts out a formal proposal, and he requests applications for people who are interested in going. And he scrutinizes all the applications and, you know, creates a short list. And most of the cavers he takes are people that he has caved with and he knows and he trusts. But both of them are also understand the importance of educating a new generation of cavers. So they will inevitably bring along some less experienced people who function like I did down in the South as Sherpas, you know, just doing kind of grunt work and learning the ropes, literally and figuratively. Mm-hmm. That's how they do it. But another, somebody asked Bill Stone, who do you think is the greatest explorer in history? And he always says Christopher Columbus. And they say, well, because he discovered the New World, right? And he says, no, because Christopher Columbus was the best fundraiser in the history of exploration. So another huge challenge, especially in North America, is raising funds, you know, corporate support for these expeditions. And Bill has, boy, he's become very good at that, and he's just tireless.
Yeah, I looked him up online and came across one of the TED lectures. These are lectures that I think are sponsored by Google.
Yes.
Or Microsoft. Oops, I don't know which one of those giants. But anyway, Stone was talking about space exploration, and that seems to be very important to him. You mentioned NASA, and he's doing work in terms of developing equipment that might be useful in space.
Yeah, he almost made the final cut to be an astronaut back in the late 1980s, and you know, it was so close and didn't quite make it, but he has retained an intense interest in space exploration. So, boy, for about the last 6 years, he has been working on a NASA-funded project. It's called Endurance, and it's a robot. It's about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. It's orange, and NASA intends to fly this thing to Jupiter's moon, Europa, where it will land, and it will melt its way down through a mile of Europa's ice cap, and they hope find a water ocean underneath it. Bill has developed it, he's created it, and he's tested it very successfully in Antarctica through, I think, several dozen feet of ice so far. So, and he's also said that he was going to establish a commercial mining operation on the moon by 2016, which sounds outlandish, but anybody who knows Bill Stone wouldn't absolutely rule it out, I'll tell you.
Yeah. How does he feel about getting older?
Well, I think... I think he doesn't like it.
Yeah.
You know? And I think because in the book I say that caves are no country for old men, you know, to steal a phrase from Cormac McCarthy there, and they do beat you up, you know, they beat up your knees, they beat up all kinds of trauma, and after a while you simply cannot cave at the same extreme level as you did when you were younger. So that said, however, Bill Stone is in the best shape of any 56-year-old man I have ever met. I mean, he is still solid as a rock. He can still, you know, run half marathons and climb 500 vertical feet of rope with a 60-pound pack. He's just an amazing, amazing specimen. So I don't think he likes it any more than any of us do, but I think he's coping with it very well.
Yeah. Well, I would think that he has a harder time with it than I do.
I would suspect you're right, because he is such an extraordinarily motivated, high-achieving fella, and because his achievements have been made not just with his brain, which is extraordinary, but with his body as well. It has required both. And, you know, frankly, I think that may be one reason why his attention is now shifting towards space exploration, because it's probably more demanding of the brain, but less so of the body.
What does he do for fun?
Well, he scuba dives. He really likes recreational scuba diving, particularly in the cenotes or the deep springs and sinkholes down in Mexico. He rock climbs. He has climbed Mount McKinley up in Alaska. He's climbed in Yosemite. So he's a rock climber. He does have now good relationships with his three sons. For a while, that was not the case, but he does now, and he spends time with them. So he's able to recreate, but having spent time with him, I tell you, I don't think it's easy for him.
There's no recliner in his living room, I'm sure.
No way. And in fact, when I first visited him at his house in Gaithersburg, Maryland, there was no furniture in the living room at all. There was some workout equipment and caving equipment and gear, and then there was like one or two folding chairs in the dining room of the house. But everything else was work-related.
Yeah. We've had an email follow-up to our earlier discussion on the miners in Chile, and that is, in terms of teamwork, can people in this kind of situation learn? You mentioned NASA a minute ago. What can we learn about living together in a confined space like that from what these explorers in super caves have done?
Well, they're learning, of course, as you might expect, that there are certain personality types that are better at it than others. One defining characteristic, this is of someone who lives in these conditions successfully, is a person or people who are able to to create or conceive alternate solutions to problems with more ease and more facility than the rest of us. They also have to be psychologists talk about two kinds of personalities. There's the I-tell personality, where it's sort of ego-centered and a natural strong leader, but there's the we-ask personality too, which is more of a team collaborative type personality, and that, the second, as you might expect, is better for long confinement and those kinds of extreme long confined activities.
Yeah, there we got to leave it. We're out of time. What
okay.
A delight to talk with you, James Tabor.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
You're very welcome. James Tabor is the author of Blind Descent: The Quest to Discover the Deepest Place on Earth. The book is published by Random House.